From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Katia Passerini celebrates her first year as president of Gonzaga University on July 15th. What is sure to be one of her highlights will come this month when Gonzaga serves as a base camp for the Egyptian World Cup soccer team. But today we talk with Passerini about other things. They include how and why to keep more Gonzaga students in Spokane after they graduate, Gonzaga and artificial intelligence, and the Zags joining the Pac-12 conference next month. Spokane Neighborhood Action Partners, which serves the region's low-income population, is celebrating its 60th birthday this year, and it's marking that with a leadership transition. We'll talk with the outgoing chief executive, Julie Honkamp, and her replacement, Amber Johnson, about SNAP's legacy and place in the community. Those stories this hour on Inland Journal. Katia Passerini's first academic year as president of Gonzaga University is over. As we prepared to start our interview, she was reviewing items on her to-do list.
I need to get more friends outside of the university. I spend so much time inside the university from morning to evening or traveling for work-related activities that I haven't had the time to enjoy the beauty that Spokane has to offer. I've done a couple of hikes, obviously the theater, Foxy Theater and the like, but I know that there is so much more.
Passerini was preparing for her first drive across the Cascades to Seattle, and then to welcome the Egyptian World Cup team to campus. Gonzaga is a base camp for the Egyptian side as it prepares for its three matches in Seattle and Vancouver. This was just a few weeks after many Gonzaga students had gone home for the summer. Passerini mentioned she had recently given a presentation at a Rotary Club meeting in which she talked about convincing more of the university students to stay in Spokane after they graduate.
It's about 2,000 students that graduate between undergraduate, graduate master education, and then law school. And we know that about 25% of that number remain in Spokane. We would like to continue to retain them. And so what I've asked to all the great business leaders that I had in front of me is to think about opportunities to create pathways for employment for young graduates that maybe might be wanting to start an experience in Spokane. They might then decide to explore the rest of the country or the rest of the world. We have a number of graduates that always goes in the Peace Corps and other type of volunteering across the world. But what we know is that some of them at some point come back, and they come when they are ready to have a family. They come back and they find Spokane to be a great place to raise children. And as you might know from Forbes magazine, about 2-3 weeks ago, Spokane was rated one of the top 20 cities in America to retire to. But I want to get them a little earlier than retirement.
Well, so I guess my point is, why is it so important to get more than 25%
yes,
or whatever the number is?
Because they contribute back what they've learned to the community. And so while we're happy that they go and spread their wings everywhere, there is a lot more that we can do for our community here. So it's important because we have done a study recently through our business school of the economic impact of a university like Gonzaga to the Eastern Washington economy. And we've found that about $750 million is our impact in this region. Our next step is to try to assess the impact in the whole Washington state and beyond. But that means that there are jobs being created, startup opportunities, contribution to civic engagement, because our students are in the arts, in engineering, in business. So there is a lot of opportunities to give back to the community, and I would love for them to consider giving back to Spokane, which is a place where I think they have received a lot, because their education is not only inside these walls. Many of our students volunteer in town, Catholic charities, and a lot of other volunteering opportunities with our Center for Civic Engagement. And so continuing that pathway of giving back, it's incredible.
So what are the areas your university is delving into is AI, and something that you're passionate about and interested in? You have an institute about that. Tell me, as AI is evolving so quickly, what's Gonzaga's role in helping to promote it, regulate it, that sort of thing?
Yes, regulate it, it's an interesting question. So the first thing with any technology that is exploding is you need to understand it, and you sort of have to follow the wave. There is what's called the Gartner hype cycle. You see any emerging technology at the very beginning, there is a boom, everything becomes AI, even things that are not AI. And then there is a period of stabilization. I think AI is a little different because we have had a boom for quite a while, and we don't know yet the direction of that stabilization, to the point that you might have seen at the beginning of this week, Pope Leo XIV has issued an encyclical, Magnifica Humanitas, that talks about actually disarming AI because of the concern that this idea of replacing human being, their thinking and becoming an extension of human being, could have indirected consequences that might displace work and people who do this work. And so what we want to do as a university is learn the technology, teach our students who have to do it in the workplace on how to use it correctly, but also understand that those unintended consequences and help address some of the those consequences. For example, work is one that I can mention. You can see that in computer science, for example, a lot of jobs are being cut from major tech organizations. This is not new in technology. Also, tech organizations now and then, they do a recycling of their workforce because they might need new skills. But certainly we have seen also application in our computer science program being slowed down because of what we see happening in the market. But then there are other impacts, for example, on the environment. The request for electricity and energy for the data center that have to support the processing of these AI capabilities, it's escalating at a level that we don't know how to meet that demand yet. So we're working with utility companies like Avista to figure out what is the next step in energy and what type of clean energy could we be also continue to develop, so that if we have to support this demand, it's not coming only from energy that is disruptive to the environment. And here I probably want to mix Pope Leo XIV with Pope Francis and his Laudato Si encyclical that talks about we need to be mindful and taking care of the environment because this is our common home. So we are looking also at Laudato Si in the context of environmental sustainability here at the university, and that's closely embedded with the way that we look at AI technologies and their development. We have worked a lot on also integrating learning outcomes related to artificial intelligence in our curriculum, especially in the core curriculum, but especially with an eye of differentiating between technology use and understanding and ethical and philosophical grounding of the technology.
So you're illustrating, I guess, the points of view that there are some people who are really bullish on AI, and there are some people who think it's the worst thing that's ever going to happen to your personal feelings along that spectrum. Where do you fall?
Well, I think technology is a tool, and so it really depends on how you use it. I do believe that there is a time in which, for example, if you have to think about the time that it takes for a new medical discovery, we're talking about 10, 15 years from the conception of a new drug to market testing. AI can dramatically reduce that, which means it might treat diseases in a much faster way that we have seen in the past. So there are reasons to be happy about that and be able to embrace that. But there is also a very real question about people and capabilities and their ability to learn as fast as a tool that continuously learn because it's, you know, it's using machine learning. So it continues to incorporate information and give you additional information. And human brains don't react that fast. And we need to understand that. We need to recognize the limits and our human limitations and be able to support a different way of even conceptualizing work. Maybe if AI can do our meeting minutes quickly, well, that's a great opportunity. If we do that in 15 minutes, the other 45 minutes we can spend it into doing something either more pleasant or critical thinking or engagement within a community. Paradoxically, I think that so much AI will continue to bring people back together in real spaces and not artificial spaces. I'll give you an example on exams. Exams for a long time, or tests at the end of a course, have always been, you know, in writing or a paper. Today, if you don't know if it is a human or a machine, the ultimate Turing test doing that paper, what do you do? Well, you can have oral examinations, and you can ask students questions on what they learned, right? So I think there actually is going to be a need to continue to bring people face to face to make sure that what we actually think is learned has actually happened. And same goes for communication. Sometimes I receive emails that I don't know if are written by a human or if they're written by a machine. And so sometimes you just have to pick up the phone and is this what you mean, you know, that you were saying? So I actually think there'll be a return to the people to people in to places interaction as AI continues to dominate.
We're talking with Gonzaga President Katia Passerini. I asked her why the university created a task force on racism after an event earlier this year on campus.
So the task force was created right after the celebration of the Harlem Renaissance. The students continued some events off campus, and there was an incident with in which racial slurs were used. And as you know, today is in a world where social media takes a life on its own. Over the weekend, there was a lot of comments around what happened and what we did on Monday when the university reopened. We immediately looked at what are the facts, what do we need to do, and what is happening. What we saw is that there was a lot happening on a third-party application, which is called Fizz, and it's an anonymous posting app where things take a life on its own. And on Fizz, I don't know if you're familiar with the application. It's an application where you join, and depending on which email address you have, you are part of a community. So every university, based on their email address, is a community. And in an anonymous way, generally students, although you don't know if they're only students because it's tied to an email address that could be assigned also to others, comment on anything that is happening in their campus community. And in some cases could be interesting comments on where to go for lunch. And unfortunately, in many cases, they're very difficult comments that borderline misogynist comments, racial, and a lot of, I would like to say, even sexual based comments. So it's an application that is unfiltered, something that we are not directly in a position to control because it's not affiliated with the university. However, in the aftermath of what happened, we immediately sent a letter to FIS, first to CIS and DESIST, which, of course, because they are an independent application, they pointed us to their social media policy as a way to complain about posts that are discriminating or infringing the social media policies. What we did is we updated our university IT policy to also include that using your own personal email for inappropriate uses is a violation of our IT policies. The difficulty for us is understanding who is behind, you know, those systems. So we have set up ways to at least be able to flag on FIS messages that we understand violate those internal media policies. And we're considering additional action that we could do. One major action, though, that I hope that we can take as a community, not only at Gonzaga, but I think across the country, is to teach students the respect of human dignity, because anonymous posting is what it is, and I think gives a lot of people liberty to say things that they wouldn't say face to face, and some of them are inappropriate, some of them are completely unacceptable and demeaning. So I'm hoping that we can work on continuing to educate everyone in our communities to be respecting others.
Having been around this place long enough, Spokane, we've had task forces on racism. We've had, and there's a lot of frustration with, we don't feel like we're getting anywhere here. Do you sense that with this particular issue on campus?
I do hear that from the students. I would say I was surprised because for me, everything happened very quickly, and I saw a series of issues brought forward that are longstanding. And so it's an important awareness, because you can only solve a problem once you're aware of it. But it's the beginning of a journey that we have to do to try to fix processes and procedures that might not be supportive of the students in the way they want to be supportive. And that leads to working together with the students. They give us a number of requests, demands on things they would like to see changed. Some of them could be things that we can work immediately on because they are short-term type of goals. Others, changing it culture takes a long time. But certainly what the task force needs to do and wants to do, and also some more recent organizational changes that I've done to my cabinet structure, is this is going to be at the forefront of everything that we do, because we need to get this right.
Okay. In a month, Gonzaga becomes a member of the Pac-12 conference. And what does that mean for you? I mean, how do you sell that to the community that may not be sports fans, but this is important for Gonzaga?
Yeah, this is really important because it is through sports, in this case, the Pac-12, that we're going to spread our wings beyond where we are. So we have been for 47 years members of the WCC. We have a lot of institutions that competed with us that are similar to us, private, small institutions, faith-based institutions, Jesuit institutions, like us for the most part. Now we're going to a new territory, you know, which is all large state institutions, Boise State, you know, Oregon State, Colorado State, Texas State. Sometimes I joke it, you know, soon you
will
see.
Pretty much the all-state conference.
Yeah, so it's pretty much you will see Gonzaga State. but in, kidding aside, I think it's really good to be an outlier in, you know, a large state system and bring something new. We are obviously not competing on the football level, but on the basketball level, I think we are very good competitors, that we can really play up a lot of those teams and play up at a very great level within the conference and in the nation. But we can also bring some of the things that our athletes value, such as connection, holistic attention to the not only your life as an athlete and on the court, but your life in the classroom and your life in the community. And we can create a lot of other opportunities for teams to engage beyond sports. So, for example, I was, prior to coming to the West Coast, I was in East Coast Big East Conference. Through the Big East Conference, a lot of the university were doing research competition, pitch competition about business ideas, art competition. We did animation and design competition, so that we were bringing other students with us to the different games. And then during the tournament at the Madison Square Garden, the team of the research teams will in the morning compete for winning a research competition, and then in the evening they will be in the finals being recognized because they won the research competition. Those are all things that we can do to bring our students to other places. And what I think it's interesting is it's also new cities that we haven't been at yet, and so it's also an opportunity to expand Gonzaga to beyond you know, our West Coast area.
Well, I know for years and years there's been talk about Gonzaga as a Big 12 member or as a Big East member, you just talked about, and you end up staying back out west. In terms of geography, is that the best thing for Gonzaga?
I think it's very important, because you need to remember that when you sign up for a conference, you're not signing up only on the for the basketball games, but you're signing up for all of your sports. And it's very challenging. First of all, our student athletes are students, and so we need to be able to put them in a position that they can do well in their academics as well as in their sports. And if you have to travel across the country for each sport that you're working on, that brings a big tax, not just on the resources or that you have to invest in a sport, but also on the well-being of our student athletes. And so I think this is a great place for us to be, and we will play it up to hopefully, you know, at the national level. And that's the aspiration.
Katia Passerini will celebrate her first year as president of Gonzaga University on July 15th. Next week on Inland Journal, we'll delve deeper into AI. We'll look at what is artificial intelligence and should people be worried about its future. We'll talk with Grant Erickson from IntelliTech and Graham Moorhead from Pangean and Gonzaga University. Spokane Neighborhood Action Partners turns 60 this year. When I think of SNAP, I think of Bob Peeler, the now retired employee who developed a reputation as Spokane's homelessness guru. Current employee Amber Johnson remembers him too.
Bob is a legend at SNAP. Everybody knows Bob. Everybody loves Bob. And I would say that things have changed in the homeless services system over time. And, you know, the approach that we take now is maybe a little different than when Bob was here. When Bob was here, we were very heavily engaged in outreach and being out in the community. And, you know, that's not something that we focus on as much as we used to, but we are the door for single homeless individuals in Spokane. So if you're, you know, a single individual or a couple without children, you're probably going to come and interact with us.
This week, Amber Johnson began a four-month transition from SNAP's chief operating officer to its chief executive. She will learn from Julie Honekamp, who is retiring this year after leading the agency for 15 years.
I'd like to say we are an entity that grew out of community action in the 60s, kind of out of the whole civil rights movement. And so those kind of values have carried us through all 60 years. And as part of being a community action agency, we're responsive to listening to local need. That part has remained the same. I say some of the things, though, that have shifted are the political uncertainty over the years. And I think back to 2008, you know, kind of the Great Recession and the pandemic and numerous government shutdowns. That is a different era than when we were first founded. I'd also say technology is really changing us, particularly in the last 10 or so years, just really the need to focus on trying to make it easier for clients to access our programs off hours, on weekends, whenever they need to. You know, the advent of things like AI and how do we help use those systems to gain efficiency. So, you know, a lot of things are the same, and yet some things are different.
Has the need increased in 25 years?
You know, I'd say the need is fairly strong. The flavors of needs sometimes shift a bit. So probably 15, 20 years ago, we did a really deep look to see what we were doing and whether others in the community were doing it. And so we spun off a bunch of things, like we used to operate food banks and a couple of other things that we shifted to our partners. And now we have focused in some areas that are very specific and are kind of our niche. So energy assistance, which is what a lot of people know us for, weatherization. We do a fair amount of small business lending and housing default counseling. So some really specific needs that we kind of help fill in our community.
So what's the evidence that those were the right moves?
Well, they're really technical, a lot of them. So things like weatherization, a lot of nonprofits maybe here in town don't have kind of the, currently have the crews and all the kind of infrared cameras and blower door testing and all that kind of niche. And we were already in that space. And so staying in kind of that line has really served our community well, as has things like doing some micro lending for small business development. So a lot of banks maybe will work with bankable folks at the higher end of the scale, but maybe if you just need a $10,000 loan, they're not as interested. And that's kind of the space that we work in, the smaller loans.
So given the fact that you're working in those areas, is your clientele different than it was 20 or 25 years ago?
Yeah, for sure. So again, back when we were doing basic food, before we started doing housing, those programs were simpler, I would say, to operate. And their needs were still great, but there's some things that others are doing in the community, and we gladly champion them to do that.
Has it been harder for you to raise money and to keep yourself going as government has sort of divested itself of those things?
It's gotten much more complex. So we have over 100 different funding sources, and the braiding together of those funding sources and the often conflicting rules and regulations require us to be really synced up with our funders and very clear with them about, hey, we can take this flavor of money to do X thing, but maybe we don't want to take this flavor because it's just too administratively challenging or it's conflicting with the money you just gave us. So I'd say it's trickier these days to take these flavors and make them all work together.
It sounds like SNAP is at the center of several big themes. There's housing and energy efficiency and climate change.
I think you're spot on. And one of the things I'll just mention is we've been really focused over the last 10 years on making sure if somebody walks in one of our doors, and there are many, that they're getting tied with all the other programs we offer. So maybe they come for energy, but it's like, oh, you're a homeowner. Is your home safe? Housing counseling. Is your home older? Weatherization. Are you in looking to buy a home? Down payment assistance. So we're trying to chain together a variety of different offerings to increase people's financial resilience. But with regards specifically to weatherization, there's home repair, there's weatherization. It is very much a building science. The files are huge. It's quite complex, you know, the number of cubic inches of leaking and air sealing. And it's an important service, though, to make sure that people are doing their best to reduce their energy bills and creating a safe environment, right? So you're breathing healthy indoor air and you aren't having a tripping hazard because you don't have the ramp, right? So we often say, too, we want you to age in place as opposed to ending up maybe in a facility that then our ombudsman program has to go and advocate for you for. So you're trying to look at people holistically.
As we said earlier, Julie Honekamp is handing the reins of SNAP to Amber Johnson, who has worked for the agency for nearly two decades.
I started here as a legal intern, actually as a work study student. I'm working in our housing opportunities department at that time. And so for me, it's really been the learning ground of, you know, watching leaders before me who I've had the chance to work side by side with embody servant leadership and what it means to be a SNAP employee, what it means to be of service to the community and to staff and to each other. And it's really been my passion. You know, my educational journey took me on an interesting path. My undergraduate degree is in environmental biology. I thought I was going to go be a lawyer for the EPA. Law school wasn't my thing. And I was fortunate enough to find a place here at SNAP, and it's really become my passion, my calling. And I feel really deeply honored to be given this opportunity.
Johnson comes in with her own ideas about the direction she wants to take the organization.
There's some real opportunity there to really meet people where they are and where they need us to be. We have a really great strategic plan in place as well that highlights some things around building and strengthening partnerships in the community and doing some more intentional advocacy work. Those are two things that I'm really passionate about as well, and I'm looking forward to kind of delving into and getting out there and using SNAP's voice and reputation and power to stand beside some of our partners who need some support and need a friendly face when times are tough.
Amber Johnson is the incoming chief executive for Spokane Neighborhood Action Partners. She's stepping in for Julie Honekamp, who's retiring. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. Hear it on the radio every Thursday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2:30. And hear it online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. That's where you can also hear our daily podcast, SPR News Today, hosted by Owen Henderson. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Join us next week for Inland Journal.